All right, so who doesn't love a good villain? In movies and television, of course, there are plenty of pretend villains to root against. But, you know, if you dig into American history, you'll find plenty of real-life examples.
And many of these lesser-known villains boast unbelievable stories of their own, stories that screenwriters and producers could only wish they came up with on their own. And in a new book, our next guest has chronicled some of those stories and paints a picture of the shadier side of American history.
Joining us now is Paul Martin. He is a former writer and editor for the National Geographic Society. His new book is Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Gene. Veronica.
You know, we had you on the air a couple of years ago on Wisconsin Public Radio for a book that you had written about unsung American heroes, but now you're back with a book on sort of the other side of America. Why swing to that other side?
Well, it's after I finished the book about heroes, I just thought it would be interesting to look into some of the more colorful villains. I've always been a history buff, and for years I'd collected stories that I'd run across in reading or on the History Channel and various places. And most of them were heroic in nature. They'd done something positive, and I really kind of started from scratch when I started looking into villains. And it was an eye-opening journey, because very quickly you can get bogged down in the horrific end when you start looking into crime. So many of the books that you find are about the horrific murders, the serial killers, and that gets old fast. So I wanted to find out about all sorts of offenders. So I made a list of every type of ne'er-do-well I could come up with, everything from counterfeiters and pirates to rustlers and gunslingers. And then I began looking for the most colorful example of each one of these that I could find. And I think the book is a lot of fun. To tell you the truth, it was more fun to research and write this than to working on the Heroes book, for a very specific reason. With these characters, I did not have to maintain a reverential attitude. With the heroes, I had to be very serious all the time. With these characters, some of them are just playing off the wall, and it was, you know, I could poke a little fun at them, be irreverent from time to time.
In fact, you break the folks in this book into three basic groups, right there in the title: villains, scoundrels, and rogues. What are the differences? I mean, they're all sort of variations on the same theme, right?
Well, exactly. What I did when I had this collection, I had, you know, several dozen people, and I started analyzing how I could organize this into some comprehensible presentation. So I decided to come up with a hierarchy of three. And the villains, of course, are the very worst of the lot. They're the serial killers and the heinous criminals. The scoundrels are a notch lower. They're still did some sort of a serious crime, but they're not of the shocking nature of that first group of the villains. And the third group, the rogues, these are the people who just, they may have only screwed up once in their life. They may have been normal people who just sort of went off the rails at some point, and sometimes it was because of a personality flaw. In other words, they were not hardened criminals. So I think by having these three layers, three levels, it just makes for a more interesting and easier to grasp presentation.
Yeah, in fact, some of the rogues, you know, you could find yourself sitting down and having a drink with them, and it would be a perfectly wonderful conversation. But some of the villains, these are people you don't want to have anything to do with, really.
Some of the villains, especially one from your neck of the woods, Ed Gein, he was so monstrous that I couldn't even write about some of the things he did. He was, of course, psychotic. He was crazy as could be, but his crimes were so horrific that you kind of talk around them. Whereas the more characters such as the rogues, I would love to sit down with. I have two characters, Maggie and Kate Fox, and they were young children in an isolated farmhouse in New York back in the 1840s, and they were sort of bored, and so they decided to play a trick on their mother, and they pretended to contact the spirit of a traveling salesman that had supposedly been killed in their house. And they did this by cracking their knuckles and toe joints. And their mother bought it entirely. She thought they were contacting the dead. The neighbors came in, and before long, this thing spread out of control. They ended up, these two young girls, one was, I believe, 11 and the other 14 at the time, they became the most well-known mediums in the country. And they started what has become known as the spiritualism movement, which is really a kind of a quasi-religion for people who believe that we can contact the dead. They eventually confessed that they'd made the whole thing up. And the interesting thing is that the believers in spiritualism didn't believe them. They didn't believe the confession. So they were sort of trapped into this persona that they created almost by accident. And it would be fun to sit down with them and chat about their experiences.
Another person that you outline in the book is a woman named Mildred Gillars. I think that's how you pronounce it. And you might not know that name, but a lot of people would recognize the name Axis Sally.
Exactly. I had heard of Axis Sally all my life, and I sort of vaguely knew that, like Tokyo Rose, during World War II, she was an American traitor. But I didn't really know her story. And she's actually rather tragic. She grew up in Ohio, and she went to college and studied to become an actress. But she just never achieved any success. She went to New York after college and got a few small acting parts on Broadway and into some traveling theater productions. But she was always just really scratching around the edges of the theatrical world. And she went to Europe to try to improve her fortunes in the 1930s and ended up getting a job with German radio. Well, when the World War II came along, the American government told all American citizens, you know, come home from Germany. And she stayed there. That was her fatal mistake. She stayed there. And because she was finally getting some artistic recognition through German radio, she preferred to remain where she was. Well, when the war began, the Germans realized they had a perfect person here to engage in propaganda. Here was an American. She had a very wonderful speaking voice. I've listened to tapes of her speaking. And she broadcast anti-Semitic rants and tried to talk with the American soldiers and allies out of fighting Hitler. And she ended up, after the war, she was brought back to this country and tried for treason and sent to prison for 11 years.
Lots and lots of stories here. We're talking with Paul Martin. He is the author of Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues. And those include some of the little-known but very bad villains that have existed throughout American history. We'll be picking that conversation up in just a moment.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with Paul Martin about his new book, Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, about some of those lesser-known real-life villains in American history. Paul Martin, we have a comment here from Bill in Lancaster who asks, did you do anything on Doc Brinkley, a quack doctor from Kansas in the 30s? He's got to be at the top of the list of scoundrels, and you did, actually.
Well, I did John Brinkley.
Oh, a different Brinkley.
Yeah, John Brinkley was, and it may be who he's thinking of. Brinkley was famous. He was known as the goat gland doctor.
Mm-hmm.
He, from the 1920s into the late 30s, made millions of dollars a year by implanting goat testicles into male patients, supposedly to restore their virility. Of course, it was useless, and 42 people died from the procedure. But he had a special train. He was in a clinic in Milford, Kansas, which was 65 miles west of Topeka, out in the middle of nowhere. And he had a special train, came out to his clinic, 50 patients a week, every week of the year, just came out there to pay $750 for this useless procedure.
And that was such a great story because he used radio at then a very new medium to kind of spread the word, and he played a lot of games in the early history of radio.
He did. He's famous because one of the first things he did was he had a medical question box, it was called. It was a show on the air, and he would take encourage people to write him with their medical problems, and he would read the letters on the air. Then he would prescribe medicines to that they needed. And, of course, those medicines were only available in pharmacies that paid him kickbacks. So he was making millions of dollars through that scam. Finally, he was run out of Kansas. He was they took his medical license away, and he ended up in Del Rio, Texas. And I think his real fame in terms of radio is he had one of the first what they call border blasters.
Mm-hmm.
They were these humongous radio towers that could broadcast virtually all over the United States, and was located in Mexico, just across the international border. So the American authorities couldn't do anything about it, and he actually did a lot of pioneering. He had some of the early country western singers. He pioneered a lot of different programming techniques that became the staple of radio.
Yep, he was a legend, and he is a very familiar story to people who follow broadcasting, but it's good that you hear about the other side, too, the part where he was a scoundrel. Another person that you focused on towards the end of the book, and it was kind of a lovable story, actually, one of those rogues I think you were talking about, the frugal counterfeiter. I'm not sure if I can pronounce his name, Emmerich Jüttner, and there's a picture of him here, and he is this sort of ancient, very pleasant-looking old man holding a bunch of dollar bills.
He was one of my favorite characters. He was a record-setting counterfeiter. He went from 1938 to 1948 without being caught. That was over 9 years. That's the longest any counterfeiter has ever operated. He didn't start till he was 63. He had come to this country as an immigrant from Austria. And when he got old, he retired, and his wife passed away, and he was in his 60s, and he was having a hard time making ends meet, so he started counterfeiting, of all things, $1 bills. That's all he counterfeited, and that was one of the reasons he didn't get caught, because nobody would think to look at a $1 bill to see if it was counterfeited. He also never victimized the same business twice because he didn't want anybody to take too much of a loss because of him. So he was really a crook with a conscience.
And there, you tell a story early on in there about he had this little dog that would go around with him, and he was very cute. And I don't want to say he was above suspicion, but who would expect this darling old guy with his dog?
He was just a lovable old man with no teeth who just smiled all the time, and he would take his fake $1 bills, which, by the way, were horrible fakes because he misspelled George Washington's name.
He printed them
on bond paper, I mean, of all things. But he would go into, like, a butcher shop and buy some scraps for his dog for 15 cents and give them a dollar bill. And then he'd get 85 cents in real change. And that, for him, was a big score, a pocketful of actual change.
Yeah, this is such a great book. There are so many good stories in here. And before we let you go, I mean, is there anybody that didn't make the book? Do we have another book of villains, scoundrels, and rogues in the making somewhere?
Oh, I have an unlimited number. I'm not sure if I want to write more about villains. I've written about heroes and I've written about villains, and there's so many other categories of interesting Americans, inventors, scientists, you name it. You could do a similar book on any topic.
All right. And the last question, who's your favorite villain in this whole thing? Who's your favorite scoundrel? Who's your favorite rogue?
Well, I don't know if I can call him my favorite, but I had a personal tie to two characters. One of them was James Lane, who was a senator from Kansas. There was a famous raid on Lawrence, Kansas, in it was 1863 or 64, in which about 200 young men and boys boys and men were killed by Missouri raiders led by William Quantrell. Well, the reason for that raid was that James Lane, who was a senator and an abolitionist, had in 1861 gone over into Missouri and burned the town of Osceola, and he hanged 9 people that he thought were Confederates. Well, my personal connection is that my father happened to have been born in Osceola. I mean, many years after the Civil War. But I had that personal connection all my life. And when I started looking into this story, it was just a wonderful story. And it actually is part of, if you've ever seen the Outlaw Josie Wales, Eastwood movie, that's the basic story. There's a character in there. I don't know if they name him, but there's a character that plays James Lane.
Well, it's a great place, and I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Paul. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on, Gene.
We've been talking about some of the lesser-known real-life villains throughout American history with Paul Martin and his new book, Villains, Scoundrels, and Rogues, Incredible True Tales of Mischief and Mayhem.
Last night, the Iron County Board deliberated and ultimately voted unanimously to evict the Harvest Camp in the Pinoki Hills. The Couturier, also known as LCO tribal members, have been occupying the area in an attempt to block a proposed iron ore mine from being established there.
Our Superior-based reporter, Mike Simonson, has been covering this issue, as you've been hearing. He joins us now to get us up to speed on the County Board's decision last night. Mike, thanks so much for being here with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, this has been in the news kind of on and off for almost the last year. Last night, all of a sudden, yesterday, the county board deliberated about evicting the LCO. They've done this before, so why did last night's meeting finally result in this unanimous decision to evict?
Well, the county board chairman wanted to do this 3 months ago, but their insurance company, the county's insurance company, feared high legal bills. So finally, they examined the situation, gave advice in closed session for about an hour, and said, go ahead, because the board unanimously voted to eject. You know, it's kind of funny, the language in the resolution doesn't say evict, it says eject, although I think everybody's assuming it means evict.
And let's talk about what we are discussing here, this so-called harvest camp that is in the middle of the forest by the Pinokis. It's been occupied now for, a year or so?
Since May.
Since May, so we're going on a year. And the point of this was a protest of the proposed Pinoki mine up there?
It's to make that statement, and they originally did ask to have a camp there, and they've erected a couple of wigwams, and there's about half a dozen people there who stay there off and on. But then it developed into a research project where they are looking at the fauna, they're looking at the animals, they're documenting a history of Native Americans in that area. And by doing that, they say it's not a camp, so they're not in violation of the 14-day camping limit.
Now, you reported yesterday that the LCO wasn't notified of this county board meeting ahead of time. So did anybody from the LCO ultimately have an opportunity to participate in the discussion before last night's vote?
The project spokesman, Paul DeMain, was there, and they packed the chambers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a huge chambers. 51 people were there, according to the clerk. But I think the bottom line here is they say that they need to enforce this ordinance or they're going to lose their accreditation to be able to log the timber, and that would cost the county $2 million. And this is a poor county. But this is going to happen in 6 business days, theoretically. But when I talk to the sheriff, you know, this isn't going to be a showdown at the OK Corral or anything to kind of take it off from your last guess. But it's going to be next week. They're going to meet with the sheriff, and the sheriff hopes things can be resolved. But, you know, everybody is saying, or I think most everybody is saying, this is going to be resolved in court, because that's where they have to get the eviction notice from.
And so that was the next question I was going to ask. What recourse now, then, does the LCO have at this point? They're going to have to go to court to try to have that question answered?
Right. They're going to have to do that. But, you know, the 6 business day thing, they're waist deep in snow there now. And the sheriff said, you know, it could be 6 days. It could be 16 days before everything gets worked out. Or it could be in court with the tribal legal counsel looking at the eviction notice and saying, no, this doesn't apply. We have treaty rights. And the fight begins in court.
And so in terms of the mood, obviously I'm guessing there was a little bit of tension at the county board meeting, but is this sort of re-raising the level of tension in that part of the state right now?
I think they're trying to, at the LCO project camp, keep a, not only civil, they're really making a point to keep it civil, but even sometimes touches of humor. And the county board, I think, feels that they're between a rock and a hard place in this. If they lose that revenue from the timber harvesting, then that will really hurt this county, this small county.
So in the next couple of days, we'll have to be watching and see, A, if anything happens in court, and then what action, if any, the Iron County Sheriff's Department takes.
Yeah, the sheriff's going to meet with them next week. It sounds so dire, eviction, eject, mm-hmm. 6 business days, but they're not going to be dragging people out of there.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks so much for taking the time to get us caught up today.
You betcha, Gene.
That's Mike Simonson. He is Wisconsin Public Radio's news reporter based in Superior, and he's been following this story and keeping us up to date on what is happening in terms of the proposed Pinoki mine and this so-called harvest camp that has been up there. And we'll see how that story develops.
Coming up, we finish our series of interviews on the third anniversary of Act 10 with a focus on how the changes to collective bargaining have affected public employees and their unions. I'm Veronica Bickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.